I was speaking about women and the impact of war yesterday at the DePaul University here in town, and I mentioned, as we all know, women in war-torn countries pay the highest price of battle in terms of losing their lives, limbs, becoming homeless. They become exposed to sexual violence, trafficking, and systematic rape as a war crime. While the less obvious aspects of their losses is the jobs they lose, the setbacks they suffer in their long struggles for bringing democracy and equality to their countries, many women lose and girls lose their support networks, their children, sisters, friends, husbands, neighbors, and often they lose people who may have had the financial sort of responsibility of the households. The psychological and the financial cost of war, of course, is a whole other area. I won't go into it. I'm sure we all know. And also the environmental impact of war. Last night, I argued that women in the states which wage wars and invasions, such as here in the United States, also suffer tremendously. Women in the U.S. military, while humanizing the face of war, pay with their lives, mental health, and limbs. They're systematically discriminated against in the U.S. military. They're underpaid, and many women, especially in the Air Force, have been subjected to rape and sexual harassment. And of course, the nation's tax money, instead of going to healthcare, education, and medical health, goes into making bombs. So we all know that. And most women who enlist in the U.S. military do it not because they think it's fun, but it's the only choice for them to make a living. And they come from very poor backgrounds, a lot of black women and other sort of racially marginalized women join the military. Almost no white middle-class women join the U.S. military. So women on either side of the crossfire, the poor here in the United States and the women in the war-torn areas, are the ultimate losers. In my talk tonight, I will try and give you a picture of who women of Iran are. I will give you a little historical background. I'll tell you a little bit about their aspirations, predicaments, before I go on to explain what a possible attack on their homeland would mean to them. So if I start with the 19th century, I can tell you that women in modern Iran have been visible and active component of their country's multifaceted liberation movements since the 19th century, ranging from being poets, rebels, theologians, to being politicians, political activists of the 1906 Constitutional Revolution. They've been publishers, teachers, writers, artists, journalists, university professors, public intellectuals, and the list is long. Later in the 20th century, under the Pahlavi monarchy, middle-class women in Iran, in urban Iran, started benefiting from liberal reforms in family law, from free education, healthcare, etc., while working-class women, rural women, and religious women were very much shunned by the imperial court, to whom they were a source of embarrassment. So this group, the majority of Iranian women did not benefit much from the country's wealth during most of the 20th century. But women who were politically active joined the oppositional groups, such as Cherikhay Fadoghiye Khalq or the Mujahideen, but these groups were militant, and they didn't really have a feminist agenda. So other women who were not ready to join these sort of militant groups, they read works of revolutionary theorists, feminist leaders from across the world, and they formed some sort of an embryonic literary movement, a women's movement in Iran, which was part of the oppositional prose movement. We call it Ta'ahud Adabi, commitment in literature. These women, they were writers, journalists, and they were laying the grounds in the latter part of the 20th century for a more democratic women's movement than what the Pahlavi imperial court offered, because a lot of monarchists, historiographers, tell us that there was this wonderful women's movement during the Pahlavi, and women benefited so much, and things were so much better during that time. It was if you were middle, upper class, urban, and not political. Female members of the revolutionary movement, they helped topple the imperial system in 1979, People's Revolution, which tragically was hijacked and Islamicized by one faction of Iranian society, by all means, not the entire society, namely the radical clerics. In short, the phenomenon of Iranian women's movement begins with the historical evidence of large numbers of women struggling for freedom, their participation in the workforce, their formation of voluntary associations, and expression of their ideals and aspirations in literature, art, political activism, and scholarship. Women in Iran have been, they're not obviously a big unanimous group. They're divided among any number of binaries, as we have it here in America. There are Iranian women who live outside Iran, there are women who live inside Iran, there are those who are radical or liberal, middle class as opposed to labor and peasantry, activists, scholars, and of course these categories are not thorough and exclusive. Women in today's Iran constitute 64% of the university graduates. They have achieved excellence in fields of literacy, education, art, journalism, political participation, cinema, and law. Since the 1979 revolution, while the Islamist and clerical class took an uncompromising revenge on the secular middle classes, women from the former backgrounds, as in the religious and the working classes, they entered the public sphere, and this gave them a chance to get into the workforce. And they now demand reform in religious thinking, and they have forced this, and they're very much part of a new progressive religious movement in Iran. During the reformist government of President Khatami, during 1997 and 2005, Iran had elected more women to its parliament than the Americans have to Congress. The picture, of course, isn't just rosy and wonderful. Most active women feminists in Iran are Tehran-based. They're middle class. They're Persian-speaking. Persian is not the majority language in Iran. There are lots of other languages that are spoken, but it is the official language. They're heavily censored and intimidated by the officials of the Islamic Republic, including conservative anti-feminist women. And even if they're not censored, their language and activism is by large predetermined by the ideological tyranny of the Islamic Republic. They constantly face the solid barrier of operating within a gender apartheid state, and therefore their advancements are very limited and often very slow. Nonetheless, this polarized urban middle class women's movement that we still have in Iran remains revolved around the pursuit of equal rights, equal legal rights, and they have a very active women's literary, press, online, and academic presence. And in the past couple of years, Iranian women have staged courageous sit-ins and street protests in large cities, and they have mobilized themselves massively through the internet, demanding changes, and it's been a precedent. And they have managed to form the largest independent women's coalition in Iran since the fall of the Shah. Informal network of women's non-governmental organizations and independent associations have asserted their grievances and demands through civil disobedience. Members of environmental and educational NGOs, staffers at Tehran University and other universities, student publications, they've all joined them too. And web bloggers, male supporters, and even Iran's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Shirin Ebadi, has given her name to their cause. Never have Iranian women, though, forget about self-serving, pathetic, oppositional groups outside Iran or career opportunist characters in US think tanks. Forget about those. But Iranian women themselves inside Iran have never called or asked for foreign involvement in their demands for achieving democracy and equality in Iran, other than appeals to international human rights groups and NGOs. In fact, Iranian women activists have refused to accept US aid. And Shirin Ebadi, the distinguished Iranian recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in the field of defending human rights, has repeatedly announced that while she and her fellow activists continue to oppose and fight Iran's gender apartheid system, they would never support, but in fact would fight a US-led assault on their homeland. So as we see, there's an active, independent, sophisticated, and uncompromising women's movement inside this theocracy that the Fox News and the CNN and the Bush administration repeatedly calls the greatest threat to world peace. Women in Iran go about their daily life. They are the cornerstones of Iranian democratic movement. And while they live under hardship, they have hopes in subverting this hardship by their own bare hands. And there are at least no bombs being dropped from the sky, no homes, schools, universities, hospitals, bridges or factories being destroyed, no lives or limbs are being lost, no friends, cousins, mothers, fathers, brothers or husbands are being killed, and no criminal gangs or an occupying army is threatening their security in the streets. Their water, their environment, and their food supply isn't polluted by any bombs, God forbid, a chemical or nuclear bomb made in the United States, nor is their cultural heritage looted or their paychecks burned. As in all recent wars in Kosovo, as in Rwanda, we know that when a war is waged, women are not only subjected to the conventional horrors of military action, as in being shot, killed, maimed, and so forth, but they're systematically subjected to rape, starvation, torture, and other horrors by their enemies or even by their own men. Women in Rwanda, for example, were deliberately raped by HIV-positive soldiers in rape camps in order to eradicate the next generation of their people. Women in the former Yugoslavia were also systematically raped and tortured, as were women in the First and Second World Wars in Japan and by other nations. And if we were to look at the current example of women in Iraq, which we hopefully see through alternative media, we see that since 2003, women and girls have not only been equally bombed and traumatized as their male counterparts, but they have been subjected to abductions, rape, and murder as a punishment for those of them that who dare hold a professional job. I quote from a recent article in the British Guardian. A women's rights campaigner, Salam, a nickname, knows about the three men in the Opal. They tried to kill her on 11th of December last year. It was a Sunday, she recalls, and 15 bullets were fired into her car as she drove home from teaching at an internet cafe. A man in civilian clothes got out of the car and opened fire. Three bullets hit her, one lodging close to her spinal cord. Her son was also hit, and she saw the gun, a police-issued Glock. She's convinced that her assassin would be working for the state. So, and bodies of young women in Iraq are appearing in dusty lanes and avenues, places patrolled by packs of dogs, where boundaries bleed into the desert, is a favorite place for dumping murder victims. Iraq's women are living with fear that is increasing in line with the numbers of people dying violently every month in that country. They die for being a member of a wrong sect and for helping their fellow women. They die for doing jobs that the militants have decreed that they cannot do, for working in hospitals, ministries, universities, all the things that they used to do before. And they speak of the terror of speaking their mind, of going out to work, and all sorts of things. And Amnesty International report says that women and girls in Iraq live in fear of violence as the conflict intensifies and insecurity spirals. Hundreds of thousands of civilians are reported to have been killed or injured in the military attacks by armed groups since the US-led invasion of March 2003. The lawlessness and increased killings, abductions and rapes that followed the overthrow of the government of Saddam Hussein has restricted women's movement and their ability to go to school, work, and they're facing discriminatory laws and all sorts of things. So I can say without any hesitation that a similar thing would happen, if not worse, if a war was waged on Iran or a bomb was dropped and the country was invaded. In fact, I think that in Iran, things might get even worse. I'll give you an example why. When the tragic earthquake of December 2003 hit the city, the ancient city of Banna, I'm sure you remember, homeless and orphaned girls were the subject of rape, trafficking, and kidnapping by criminal gangs. The lucky ones who had remaining relatives were bodyguarded day and night and outside these makeshift schools to shield them from being kidnapped and raped. So wars, natural disasters, and civil unrest always means chaos. And in chaos, violence, and particularly crimes against women and girls, increases. So in a vast country such as Iran, where, like all societies, domestic violence, rape, and more increasingly the trafficking of poor women is common, a war would mean a humanitarian catastrophe, not only for individual women and girls, but for women as a collective force in the democratization of the country. Setbacks in all their efforts for political, legal, and cultural gains would perish with the first bomb that would be dropped by any foreign country on their homeland. All the energy and attention would be diverted to safeguarding the nation, and in the vast nation, women and girls will be forgotten and trampled upon. Today, when young Iraqi women are abducted and murdered without a ransom demanded, a common daily reality, they have been kidnapped solely to be raped. Even those raped and released are not necessarily safe. The response of some families to finding that a woman has been raped has been to kill her. The very same will be the scenario in many parts of Iran should war occur. Women rights activists in Iraq state that they have been betrayed by their country's new constitution that guaranteed them a 25% share of membership of the Council of Representatives. That guarantee has turned instead into a fig leaf hiding, which they now call a human rights catastrophe for Iraqi women. This will be the same in Iran should a US-led military regime change occur. The Christian right Bush administration, self-serving native informers, the Iranian Chalabis of this world, oppositional groups, think tank experts, do not have the interest of women, especially working class and poor women in mind, but the interest of corporate and capital that provides them with lucrative grants. So what is alarming for any human rights, women's rights, or anti-war activist in this country is that in all the recent wars, the new con doctrine has been adopted to persuade the public into going to war in the name of democracy and the liberation of Muslim women. This claim is categorically false and indeed criminal. Not only are the intentions of going to war not in order to promote any such a thing as human rights or democracy, however one can achieve this by bombing a nation into it, the consequences of such wars are catastrophic setbacks and direct crimes against women's human rights and for humanity at large. As committed activists, our task is not allowing the women's rights issue or the matter of democracy to get hijacked by warmongers. It is our duty to oppose and expose the cause of women and or the marginalized from being used by statesmen, military men, native informers, posing as feminist human rights activists, scholars, for acts of violence. We must ask ourselves if these statesmen, military people, native informers, if they really believe in the full emancipation of women in their own countries. We must ask, does Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz really care for black and poor women in New Orleans before they go on to liberate these women? The native informers posing as defenders of the cause of women from their country of birth, not only haven't got a blasted clue about women's long efforts for bringing democracy to their countries, but are supporters of the same capitalist anti-women policies which denigrate and put women in hardship in the so-called developed West, depriving them, women, of free education, healthcare, and equal opportunities in this country. As the preeminent anti-racist feminist Zila Eisenstein states, the US at present is not what a democracy looks like, neither is feminism. One and the same with the Bush administration's appropriation of women's rights talk on behalf of Afghan women or women in the US military. In a fragile civil society such as Iran, the last thing women or Iranians need in their noble struggle for democracy is an illegitimate and immoral American-led war. Our nightmare now is that Iranian women and girls may not only have to deal with their daily hardships of life under a theocracy, but may indeed have to bear the terrorizing consequences of a US-led invasion. With all the implications for women I just explained in the Iraqi situation, left to their own devices, Iranian women, as elsewhere, will surely pave the way for democratic societies one day. Thank you.